Welcome back to another Baseball America Prospect Podcast. We're staying with the top 30 deep dives. Today we are diving into the Tampa Bay Rays top 30. JJ Cooper is joining me as he writes the Rays top 30 for the handbook. JJ, how's it going today, man? How are you?
Not bad. Happy to talk. A little bit of a behind the curtain. We're recording this as we just got done doing a top 100 rankings meeting. Always fun to do. And we're going to be talking about a Rays system that even in the time since we did the prospect handbook, which was literally less than a month ago, a whole lot has changed.
Yeah, it feels that way. And, you know, just constant stream of feedback, particularly, you know, as the top 100 kind of process begins and we start to hammer out a list, we certainly get more specific feedback on certain players. And it's not just, you know, how they line up against other players in their respective systems, but sort of the global, you know, ranking. And I think sometimes that's a little tougher, right? Because depending on who you're speaking with within the game, they could have a wide variety of opinions or preferences. There's obviously biases as well that all come into play. So kind of interesting, but let's dive into this Rays system here. Before we go into any of the rankings, just from a general sense, what's sort of the state of the organization, state of the system? Is it a system that has players that could graduate and, you know, contribute in the next, you know, season in 2026? Is it more of a wait and see kind of a system that has maybe depth with younger high upside players? Sort of what's the sort of defining characteristic?
It's now both, because obviously the main thing that happened is in this offseason, trading away guys like Shane Baz, trading away Brandon Lau, has basically they were traded for prospects. And so I would say the Rays are not, you know, I don't think that the Rays are conveying that, hey, this is a lost season and we're just looking down the road. But I don't think you could in any way say anything other than this is getting worse in the short term to try to get better in the long term. The Rays are not a team also who is unwilling to kind of do that kind of thing. If you look 2 years ago at the a season and a half ago, I should say, from now at the deadline, they did a massive sell-off and brought in a lot of prospects. And some of those ranked pretty high on this system. Some of those have taken big steps back since they were traded. That's what happens when you trade for prospects. And especially, I love to emphasize this to people. Anytime you see players traded for non-top 100 prospects, really non-top 50 prospects, but especially non-top 100 prospects, there is a lot of risk there of whether those players are going to pan out or then kind of fade into obscurity. And in the Rays case, they traded primarily for some very intriguing guys, but non-top 100 guys in most of these cases. The trades they've made this offseason, there is a top 100 guy in it, but it's mainly for non-top 100 guys. Some of those are going to pop. Some of those are going to fade back. There is something about going for prospect volume, and that's something the Rays have done now. But I would say when you look at the AL East right now, and you look at the Blue Jays, who are about two hairs length away from being world champions, and then you look at the Red Sox, who, as we recorded this, just added Ranger Suarez and have now an extremely deep rotation to go with a pretty intriguing young lineup, especially with Roman Anthony fully healthy this year, back from where he was at the end of last year. You look at the Yankees, who were there just a couple of years ago on the precipice of a world championship, have an AL crown to their credit recently. And then you look at the Orioles, who obviously took a step back last year, but are clearly trying to make that a one-year blip, have been very active on the free agent market and making trades, including a trade with this Rays team. So you put it all together, and I would say that this is an organization that has some questions. You know, Carson Williams, when you ask about that, we'll talk about him more, I'm sure, in a minute, but Carson Williams is 100% a guy who we would expect to see contribute in 2026. And there's other guys. There's some pitchers who we might see in the big leagues. But I would say more than anything, with all these trades they've made, there is going to be pretty impressive prospect depth at all levels of the full season minors. And that's what we'll also kind of dive into on this.
Yeah, so let's get into the system a little bit here. Let's get into the rankings. You can see them on the bottom of the screen on your ticker. How difficult was the decision to rank Brody Hopkins at one? Because there are some players, I think, within a similar tier, or at least one, and Theo Gillen. Was it really between those two? Because obviously Melton was a late addition to the system.
I would say even Carson Williams. I think you could go down to now who's now four. You could make a case for Carson Williams, I think. Carson Williams was the clear number one coming into last year. And he did some very good things and some not so good things this year, I would say. On the good side, he led all minor league shortstops in home runs. That's very good. He also had a strikeout rate that is rather worrisome. And those concerns, and I think I'm being kind when I say rather worrisome, and those issues carried over when he was kind of a call up to the big leagues, in part because, and by their own doing, the Rays kind of ran out of shortstops. I mean, when I say run out of shortstops, I don't mean, oh, we don't like what Taylor Walls is doing. Taylor Walls got hurt. Oh, they traded away shortstops at the deadline. They turned around, and after further injuries happened, if you had come into the season saying, well, Carson Williams is our fifth option right now as far as who's going to play shortstop at the big league level if injuries happen, options 1, 2, 3, and 4 had all either gotten hurt or had been traded. So they kind of turned to Carson Williams partly by, well, we don't have anyone better. And he's good defensively. You knew that you would get solid defense from him, although his metrics weren't great in his debut, but he's always been known as a very good defensive shortstop. And you knew that you might see some power and you might see a ton of strikeouts. And that's what we saw in the majors. I've used this a couple of times, maybe even on the podcast already. If you say where Carson Williams is now, which is coming off of a disappointing year, but compare it to where Colson Montgomery was at this time last year, I would say that Carson Williams is in higher esteem than Colson Montgomery was at this time last year. Colson Montgomery then went out and had a very up and down, but very solid major league debut with the White Sox. It's not crazy to think that Carson Williams had a bad year last year, kind of a dip of a year, comes back a little stronger this year, makes a little bit more contact. Don't expect him to be like a 280 hitter or anything like that, but this is the guy who could hit 220, 230 in the big leagues and be a very productive player. The Rays have kind of shown that. Taylor Walls is like, oh, 220, 230, that sounds great. Well, Carson Williams could do that and hit 20 bombs. And if you do that and play good defense, that's a very valuable shortstop. So he's four because of the risk. If he strikes out 35% of the time in the big leagues, I don't care how good your defense is. I don't care how much good your power is. You're probably going to struggle to be a productive big leaguer. That's why he's not one. Theo Gillen, I think, is probably a year away because he, although it was a great debut, it was something where he's in low A. He was learning a new position, took to it pretty well, but all that. But then Brody Hopkins, I would say, actually kind of earned the number one spot more than anything. The feedback we got, you and I have talked about Brody Hopkins a lot. I'm going to kick it back to you a little bit because I know you love Brody Hopkins too. The feedback we got, the more and more we kind of dove into Brody Hopkins, the stuff is just so good. And the improvement that we are seeing from him year in, year out is such where it's hard not to get kind of excited about what he could be. You could look at his age and say, oh, shouldn't he be a little further along? But then you got to remember, this guy was an outfielder who pitched a little bit until very late in his college career. And the stuff, I mean, just as far as pure stuff, there's not a whole lot of pitchers in the minor leagues who are nastier at their best than Brody Hopkins.
Yeah, I really agree with that. And, you know, I think that, you know, the point about his background as a two-way player who is primarily a position player early in his collegiate career, I think is important context just in terms of the refinement with Hopkins, that he was always a few years behind other college starters, that he's almost in some respects kind of like a JUCO guy, where he had like this one season as a mid-major starter that was in the weekend rotation consistently, and has been able to build up. And I think, as you said, the stuff is excellent. Just kind of break it down. Sat 96.6 this year. So that fastball is sitting 95 to probably 98 miles an hour. Had a 101 mile per hour peak. And it's got a ton of spin, ton of raw spin, averaging about 2,500, 2,600 RPMs of raw spin. So there's, I think, spin traits there that he could throw a two seam if he wants to add that. But it has movement, as you said, from a very low release height. He gets good extension. It's a lower arm angle as well. That creates one of the flatter four-seam fastballs in the game. I think he'll continue to miss bats in AAA this year and eventually in the majors with that pitch. You know, he's got hard secondaries and a low 90s cutter, an upper 80s curveball that I know that we've spoke about this before, and I'm sure I'll write about more of it in the best pitches in the top 100. I think it's one of the best curveballs, not just in the minor leagues or in the handbook. It might be one of the best curveballs thrown by anyone on the planet. It sits 88 miles an hour and has a ton of total movement. And, you know, for as much as it moves and as hard as it is, and the knocks that he has as a strike thrower, it has a well above average strike rate and, you know, an average to slightly above average zone rate for a curveball. I actually think that his strike throwing is maybe a little bit undersold.
I agree.
When you dive into like the end zone rates and that sort of thing. What do you think about that, JJ?
Oh, I agree. And by the way, if you want to talk about something that I generally do not worry about much, it is the Rays' ability to, I'll put it this way. If the Rays cannot get you to average control, you will not get to average control. The Rays are really good. We'll get to this later as a topic, but they've already helped Popkins improve this. I think it'll continue to improve. He has athleticism. He has kind of, I think that the trend line will just continue to get better. We've seen it get better already. I think it'll continue to get better. And that's going to kind of lead to better and better in zone rates. And as we said, like, I mean, his curveball kind of breaks your brain a little bit because it is a curveball. It's not a slider. This is an actual curveball, but with the power that there just aren't many curveballs that you could even try to compare it to. Guys don't throw 88 mile an hour true curveballs.
Yeah. And like I said, it's an above average zone rate. It's one of the higher strike rates actually among curveballs in the minors that were thrown 200 or more times. He lands his cutter a lot. And the fastball command, I would say, is average to fringy average. He doesn't land his sweeper all that much, but when we talked to him at the Futures game, I remember him saying that he was, you know, purposely throwing it less. So just, yeah, overall, I think he's a really interesting starter, a potential starter. And while there's maybe questions regarding his strike throwing and maybe a little bit of relief risk, I think if he is a reliever, he's going to be a damn good one because of the level of stuff that he has. And you're going to see a lot more 99 to 100 if he's coming out for an inning with a curveball that's maybe sitting 90 miles an hour. But I do think he, you know, has the athleticism and, you know, at least the underlying traits to continue as a starter. You know, I've been a fan for a long time.
I think he's very much a starter, and partly also because I think that the Rays are going to have every reason to develop him as a starter. When you look at kind of the mix that they have, they have some other guys coming up who are, I would say, much more likely relievers. And I think that when you look at kind of what they have coming, it makes it like they have a lot of potential starters coming too, but it really, like, Hopkins is where their grouping of starters is. Hopkins is the guy. If you said, look through all their pitching prospects, who here, if everything breaks right, could be that front of the rotation starter, that playoff starter. He's kind of fits that bill more than most of the guys that they have, I would say. And the other thing on top of that is, you know, he's a little bit closer to the majors than most of those guys. So that's the second part. And then the third part is they have, like, they're going to have like when you talk about strike throwers, the Rays have multiple players who are among the best control and command in the minors. They can, you know, kind of, again, if Hopkins, this is the team that started Joe Boyle last year and he had his ups and downs. They're willing to kind of ride out a little bit to help a guy get to where he hopefully could be.
Absolutely. So let's move along a little bit and let's talk about the system year over year. How many years have you been writing the Rays system now? Has it been a decade or close to it?
I don't know if I've done it every year, but I've done it definitely over, I think, the span of a decade at some point. I don't think I've done 10 times I've done the Rays, but I've done the Rays in different eras of Rays prospect. I definitely wrote up like Wander Franco and all. Wrote up Junior Caminero coming up. I don't remember the first year I did it, but it may have been pre-Wander Franco. So that gives you an idea.
Yeah, I think it's been at least all five handbooks that I've been a part of. So year over year, the 2024 going into 2025 version of this system versus the 2025 going into 2026 version of this system, is it better or is it worse?
It was worse and now it's better. So like you got to look at this two different ways, right? If you just look at it coming out of the season, pre-trades, I would say it was a little worse. Graduations of a couple of guys, Chandler Simpson graduated. You know, I like Chandler Simpson. But I would say on top of that, multiple guys who, whether because of injuries or ineffectiveness, just took steps back, right? Braden Taylor, we're not going to talk too much about him on this, but took a massive step back. Trey Morgan, the concerns that he faced the first baseman coming into the season, didn't have a terrible season, but I would say that those concerns about the lack of impact for a first baseman are magnified. Xavier Isaac had a very injury-plagued season, then had a brain surgery. I mean, like significant kind of issues that he had to deal with. But when he did play, there were real struggles there as well. So you have players who kind of took a step back. So then you would say, okay, maybe it's a little bit worse. But then we had the trades. And all of a sudden, guys who, I mean, to put it this way, Trevor Harrison was kind of in that Yadier Arenado, where guys who were in that mix for 10. I was like, huh, do I want these guys at 10? Do I want Nathan Flewelling at 10? Those were guys who were right in that top 10 area. The trades happen, and all of a sudden you're looking at it, and Arenado's 17th on the Rays system. Now, if you said he was 10 or 11, you'd be saying, okay, that's a perfectly acceptable player in a decent system to be ranked 10th or 11th. There are definitely systems that have much worse players ranked at that range. You say 17th for him, there aren't a whole lot of organizations who have players. I mean, we both like Arenado. This is a guy who can play second base, who can hit. He's a little bit too aggressive, but he really can hit. He's a batting champion in the minor leagues. He's shown more power, kind of especially in the winter ball this year. He can definitely stay in the dirt. You put all that together, and that's a guy who, I mean, he's kind of in that second now, that definitely second tier, which also pushes guys down. Ty Johnson, who had an incredible year at Double A. If Ty Johnson's 13th, 14th in your organization, you know, because he's almost assuredly a reliever because of the pitch mix and the arm slot and all that, okay, that's fine. If he's in your 20s, he's 22 on the system now, then you're talking about, wow, that's really deep. I would say that, you know, we talk about that there's the systems where you get to 25 and you're going, who else am I going to write about here to get to 30? The Rays now are a system where it's like, I literally have 8, I think, additional reports for guys who were written and then got pushed out because of all these trades. They brought in a pretty massive influx in the Boz trade, obviously brought in multiple prospects from the Orioles, including Michael Ferret, who went straight into their top 10. Then you got Slater DeBron. You got Caden Bodine, who immediately becomes the best defensive catcher in the organization, you know, and Austin Overn. And then they also had the Brandon Lau trade, where three-team trade, and that added two of the top prospects in their organization now, because Jacob Melton is a top 100 caliber prospect, and Anderson Brito is right in that, you know, right at the back of the range of a top 100. So it really did kind of reshape them. And does make this now, I would say, one of the deeper systems in Major League Baseball, because that's what, when you trade, they didn't, we've seen a lot of trades, right? Like, so the Marlins are getting deeper because the Marlins have made a number of trades. I would say, though, right now, the trades that the Rays have made have brought back more impact, I would say, than the trades that the Marlins have made.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And we're going to dive into, I think, some of those trades in the later part of this in the podcast version, so we can keep things moving. But who's your guess for who's going to be number one next year? Do you think Brody Hopkins will, you know, exceed rookie limits and, you know, potentially not be eligible next year? Do you think he'll make a return to the number one spot? Or do you think Theo Gillen or somebody else is maybe the front runner at the moment?
So I do think Hopkins has a pretty decent chance to graduate. So that's one. But there's something else here that if you're a Rays fan, you're probably pretty excited about. Nothing against Theo Gillen. Nothing against any of the guys who are currently here. The Rays picked two in the draft. If the White Sox won the lottery, and they did because they get Rock Chulosky, but the Rays really won the lottery because they're the team who kind of like, oh, they kind of came out of nowhere to get a what should be an exceptional pick, let's just say. Like, okay, pretty good chance Rock Chulosky will be off the board. If you're the Rays, that's fine. You know, you are looking at multiple extremely intriguing guys. If you tell me that Grady Emerson, Justin LeBron, AJ Gracia, you know, like Liam Peterson, there's a multitude of ways they could go here, Derek Curiel. There's a multitude of ways where, at least coming into this year's draft, before any games are played, it looks to be really deep, but it looks to be really solid at the top. Jacob Lombard. Like, we have so many names that we could throw out here, and it's like, picking two in this kind of draft is probably the player they take should be a top 35 to 40 prospect in the game. So that's kind of the marker that I would say has been put down here for if Hopkins doesn't graduate. If Hopkins, I had trouble believing the Hopkins who is in that range now, a better prospect than that now, but if he's that good this year, he's going to graduate probably, unless something weird happens or the Rays really are like, nope, we're rebuilding, so just stay down in the minors. We'll see you next year. And then you get a guy like Theo Gillen. I think Theo Gillen could be really good, but at the same time, I think that whoever they draft at two is probably going to have a similar skill set, probably a little bit even louder tools. And so Gillen's going to have a really good year this year to edge that out. And then, but this is a team where I would say this is an organization that has a number of guys because of the depth they have now, where maybe something a little bit more crazy happens, right? Like, you could see a Daniel Pierce, who was their first round pick last year. I don't think he's going to leap into number one, but that's the high school shortstop who was their first round pick last year who could. I think you could also see one of these pitchers, like we've talked about, like this wave of younger pitchers they have. Trevor Harrison, if something really clicks, could he vault into that group? Potentially. You know, I don't think it's going to be Jose Urbina. I don't think it's going to be Santiago Suarez, but there's a lot of different paths this could be. I think this will be one of the more interesting developments of who's number one a year from now of these. The one I will say is that it won't be Carson Williams, because Carson Williams either will have graduated or will not be number one if he's somehow still prospect eligible.
Yeah, a lot of options, and obviously that number two pick looming, more than likely could be the number one prospect going into next year, especially in a pretty good draft. All right, last question here for the video portion of the show. What is this organization good at developing, JJ?
Okay, so I'm going to start with kind of pointing out something, and this is not a knock on the Rays. It's just I would push back a little bit about conventional wisdom. You know, there's the whole meme that it's like, oh, the Rays made a trade. I love it for the Rays. Who did they get, right? That's been a meme for a long time. The Rays win and lose trades because they are happy to make trades at a level that most other organizations are not. They are willing to consider trading anyone. So you can look at trades that they've won, and then you can look at trades like Curtis Meade for Christopher Sanchez, and you're like, they lost that one badly. They have some of those. They won Junior Caminero for, help me, the high IVB fastball pitcher who bounced back with the Brewers this year.
Tobias Myers.
Tobias Myers. Thank you. Clearly won that trade, right? They win trades, they lose trades. But the other thing I'll say, though, that is kind of, I think, a little bit lost now is this has not been over the 2019 to 2023, which I think is the area that we can study, 2022, where you can say we have a better idea now of what these guys are. It has not been a great organization during that stretch of drafting or signing international players and developing them into stars. There are some successes here, but more of what their success has been their willingness to trade and develop. They are, when we look at their top 10 that you're looking at here, Brody Hopkins trade, Theo Gillen drafted, Jacob Melton trade, Carson Williams drafted, TJ Nichols drafted. So, but that's the other answer I'm going to give here. TJ Nichols is the example of this. They are also, though, what they are good at doing in development, no organization is better at helping pitchers find the strike zone, whether it's cleaning up deliveries, whether it's simplifying or picking a array of pitches that will help the pitcher stay in the zone, whether it's their ethos that we've written about for a couple of years ago about how if you don't have great control, they're just going to put the glove in the middle of the plate, you know, middle of the zone and say, trust your stuff, throw to here. And then you're going to miss it. And then you're going to miss it up. You're going to miss it down, but you're going to be around the zone because instead of trying to hit the corner of the zone, you're trying to hit the middle, which means that your 12 inch miss may still be in the zone, your 10 inch miss or your 8 inch miss or your 50, you know, maybe you set up here and then you end up over there. They do a really good job of that. TJ Nichols, to me, like we can talk about other guys. There's plenty of examples at the big league levels for them, but TJ Nichols is an example of development success story that way. When he was drafted, his scouting report was really good stuff, no idea where it's going. And you look at that guy compared to what TJ Nichols was this past year, where he's now a really consistent strike thrower. He's not the only one. There are plenty of stories in this Rays organization of pitchers who do that. They're really good at it. You know, we could talk about, again, the Joe Boys. We could talk about Shane Boz, who, you know, kind of developed before they went moved on. We could talk about Tyler Glasnow if you wanted to go back a ways. You could talk about guys for years and years, Jeffrey Springs, all these guys who, when the Rays get them, they figure out a way to get them to throw more strikes, and then that helps unlock because these are guys who generally have stuff. I think the Rays are very good at that, and again, the Rays, when it comes to trade, they do such volume of trades. Their willingness to make trades means that they're always – they're willing to lose trades in addition to winning trades because they figure that they're going to try to win it on the margins of we're going to make more of them and we're hopefully going to be a little faster and a little bit better about doing these than other teams.
I think that makes a lot of sense. JJ, let's wrap up the video portion of the show. For those tuning in on YouTube, thank you for tuning in. We'll be back later this week with even more prospect deep dives as we go through all 30 systems. Those listening on the podcast, stick around because we get a whole lot more Rays talk to come.
Every day, companies you've probably never heard of are making billions off your personal data. Your name, address, phone number, even details about your family are pulled from public records in the internet and then sold without your consent. There's an entire marketplace making money off of your privacy, and most people have no idea it exists. Aura's online security capabilities have allowed me to feel safe when it comes to my online presence. Aura fights back. They remove your personal data from broker sites and keep it off. Aura also alerts you fast if your information shows up in a breach or on the dark web. But Aura is more than just a data broker removal. It is a full digital security suite that protects every part of your life online. Aura gives you a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager to keep logins safe, and spam call protection to cut off scammers. Aura also scans the dark web for your most sensitive information, like your social security number, bank logins, and passwords, and notifies you instantly if they're exposed. Aura also removes what is already exposed, protects what's not, and puts you back in control. Right now, you can try Aura free for 14 days when you visit aura.com/remove. That's enough time for Aura to start removing your personal information from data broker sites. Sign up today at aura.com/remove and get the peace of mind that your privacy, identity, and finances are safeguarded. That's aura.com/remove. Certain terms apply. See the site for details.
All right, we are back with the podcast remaining portion of the Rays Top 30 Talk here on the Baseball America Prospect Podcast. All right, JJ, let's talk a little bit. This is the question I wanted to throw at you first. How much did the Rays like the 2025 MLB draft? Because they had quite a few high picks here between the first two rounds, between Daniel Pierce, Brennan Summerhill. Pierce got $4.3 million at pick 14. Summerhill got $2 million at pick 42. And then Cooper Fleming and Dean Moss both got well over $1 million. And then they traded for Caden Bodine, and they traded for Slater DeBrun, who I believe got maybe $4 million out of the draft. So a lot of high-end high school players, and then that elusive Rays catcher that we'll talk about at the end of the show.
Seven top 100 picks when you throw in the Orioles trade, which, by the way, if you're the Rays, obviously one other benefit of that, like you just mentioned, like, so you're effectively, your draft budget got larger without having to spend money on your draft budget, because the Orioles cut the check and then give you the player effectively 6 months later. No, they clearly did. And I do think that 100%, when you say what is the future of the Rays, it's going to depend in somewhat on how well they hit on this 2025 draft, because there's just so much talent that they brought in this. And you mentioned a lot of high school players here. You can argue that high school players are generally a little bit riskier than the college demographic. That generally has proven true. At the same time, one of the ways you can mitigate that risk is you don't draft a high school player. You draft all the high school players, because that's kind of what the Rays did here. So, like, if you said, are all these high school players going to hit? I could feel very comfortable in telling you, no, they will not. But if you told me that Cooper Fleming pops and Cotton Gray doesn't, or vice versa, or Dean Moss does, or Daniel Pierce, or Slater DeBrun, we just go through all this kind of combinations, some of those likely will hit, because these are a lot of pretty high ceiling prospects that they brought in. And the key thing about this, because of the way they did this, when you bring these guys in, and again, this is how we do it, it's a little artificial, it's not, you know, it, but none of these guys are coming in. The highest ranked player we're talking about out of this group in the Rays top 30 is Pierce, who's 8. And then you're talking about guys who are kind of in the 12, you know, to 20 to 20 to 30. And then guys like Totten Gray, who's really interesting, really high ceiling potential prospect, who was in the top 30, was written up, is in the handbook, but then these Orioles and Astros trades happen and he's no longer in the 30. There's a lot of different guys here who could end up developing into very high ceiling prospects. The funny thing about it is like some of the guys even a little bit lower. I mean, I would say they're riskier, but I do think that like Gray is kind of a fascinating catcher prospect. We'll see if it's catcher, is probably more, you know, bat, but there's a lot to be interested in there. They went twice to the shortstop well with Pierce and Fleming. They also, again, like Slater DeBrun was one of the more toolsier. They love their up the middle outfielders. They've added another one there. They added Austin Overton also, who can run as another outfielder. There's a lot of restocking here that happened in one draft. And then, by the way, as we mentioned earlier on this, that's before it's not just that they pick two in a very talented draft, but there's all the financial benefit you get from as far as your pool by picking two as well. And by the way, they're the Rays, you know, so it's picking two and it's, you know, generally having supplemental picks as well and all that. So the 2026 draft should be very good to the Rays as well when you look at what the system's going to look like a year from now.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, there's different types of depth, right? when we talk about depth within systems. Could be pitching depth that's major league ready. It could be depth of players who are major league ready with maybe, you know, more average sort of everyday
type. Or fringe stuff. Average, like platoon roles.
Yeah, exactly. But where I'm going with this is I feel like there is a depth of upside within this system. Even outside of that group of draftees, you talk about some of the other guys outside of 10. Aiden Smith is a guy that has a lot of upside. We talked about Xavier Isaac, unfortunate issue. I think if he comes back fully healthy to what he was, there's a lot of upside in that bat and the raw power that he possesses. Guys like Nathan Flewelling, who's a really intriguing player. Trevor Harrison, who we know has huge stuff and potential upside. And you can kind of keep going. Even Jose Urbina was a guy that I really enjoyed watching throughout the season when he was starting. And I was kind of, watching a variety of minor league games. Tended to tune into him because I like the mechanics. I like the stuff. A little undersized, but, an interesting player.
They have a legitimate shortstop.
He's actually bigger than I thought. So scratch that on Urbina.
But they have a legitimate shortstop. Let's say that Williams is, again, we'll see if Williams starts the year triple A or the majors. Let's say the majors. But he's a really good glove at shortstop. Now, Gregory Berrios, not a great hitter, but is a really good glove, and he's going to be at double A or triple A. Adrian Santana needs to add, ideally, about 20 pounds of muscle to be a really impactful player, but he is an excellent defensive shortstop. Then you go down to a Daniel Pierce. Daniel Pierce could be a really good shortstop. Like, when you talk about depth, that's one way they have depth. This is an organization that has like four full season guys this year who are probably all sixes or better defensively at shortstop. That's unusual. That's 55s at least for all those guys. You look at center field and Aiden Smith, that was one of Aiden Smith had a poor year at the plate. The great development, though, is he went from being, we think that Aiden Smith might be able to play center field, to Aiden Smith is one of the best defensive center fielders in this organization. And that's an organization where, like, if you aren't plus, if not plus plus, they're like, you can't play center for us. We always have a plus, like, we want our corners to be 55 or better center fielders. That's generally what they play in the corners. But you have him. You have, again, we mentioned Slater DeBrun, but you also have Austin Overn now. Like, they've got Homer Bush Jr. is the strangest player in the minors in some ways, which is that physically, if you said who are some of the most physically imposing center fielders in the minors, Homer Bush Jr. is football sized. He could play, like, he has that kind of, almost an NFL type body. He also did not hit a home run this past year. So the power is not there despite the strength he has. But that's up the middle. Now they have catching depth, which is something that the Rays do not develop catchers. If you look at the Rays' history of developing catchers, it does not exist. If you look at the Rays' ability to have a long-term catcher, the Rays basically, I've kind of asked guys with the Rays about this, like, they seem to, I would say, either value catchers differently than most organizations, or if they don't value them differently, I would say it this way. They don't think that the price to have an all-round, good-to-glove, who can hit catcher, the price to pay for that is usually more than they're willing to. Maybe that's what it is. Whatever it is, the Rays' history of catchers and developing catchers is a very, very poor one. But if you look at it right now and you say, okay, well, what are they at catcher? Well, Dominic Keegan, to his credit, I would say that Dominic Keegan is both a guy whose limitations are pretty clear. Like, he always puts up pretty solid offensive numbers. I would describe him as a really good bad ball hitter. Not bad ball, mistake hitter, okay? If you ramp up the velo and locate against Dominic Keegan, you're probably going to get him out. if you ramp up the velo and then you spin it and you keep that, you know, you keep the, your breaking ball down in the zone and away, and you're changing eye levels and all that, you're probably gonna get Dominic Keegan out. If you hang one, Dominic Keegan's gonna do something to it. He can do that. He's gotten better defensively. He's always gonna probably have a little bit of a problem with his, you know, his throwing is kind of always impacted by how long it takes the ball to get out and all that, but he could be a big leaguer. But then behind him, we talked about like Flewelling. I think you love him too, right? Like Flewelling is kind of one of the more interesting young catchers. He caught more games than pretty much anyone in A-ball last year as a teenager. Like he was his durability really stood out. But on top of that, it's really loud offensive potential upside. Like there's a plate discipline combined with power combo here. That's really kind of what you would want to see in the young catcher starter set to go with, again, the leadership and the tools to potentially be a solid defender behind the plate.
Yeah, I think that's what's so interesting is it's a combination of athleticism. Like he's a really good athlete. He's one of the better athletic testers. It's big left-handed power. 90th percentile EV was like 105.1 at 18 years old for a majority of the season. There's a little bit of swing and miss, but it's not at a rate where it's terribly concerning. I mean, it's like, you know, there's swing and miss. It's kind of, you know, one of those things that gets mentioned in a scouting report, but it's not something that I think, you know, has totally limited the profile. You want to see some improvements there. Pretty good swing decisions, pretty good angles. So there's a lot to like with Flewelling. And then as you mentioned, the catching, and I think just the potential for him to be, you know, maybe a plus defender long-term back there, just based on the athleticism and, you know, being able to learn the position. But we can kind of get into a little bit on the Rays catching history in a moment.
Well, could I just want to add with that Flewelling? Yes, there was a swing and miss. I will say if you in your first full pro season catch that many games in mm-hmm. Charleston, South Carolina and around that league, and you don't wear down, something's almost wrong with you. Like you must have like a nuclear, you know, reactor within your body or something. Cause like that is, I cannot imagine dialing up something more difficult than, hey, I'm going to catch a lot of games. It's 90 with the humidity of 110% tonight, you know, and it's that way all week this week. And I'm going to be out there every night. So like he really held up to that. And by the way, that we didn't even get to Caden Bodine, who is a really like, the combination of Flewelling and Bodine is a great pairing from the standpoint to me of like Flewelling is like, if everything breaks right, this guy could be really good. Bodine is the guy who I'd say like, if he's not a solid defensive catcher with, let's just even call them survival skills offensively, right? You could say he's not going to give you profile power for the position. I think that's very reasonable. But if you said, is he going to work counts, make contact, be a pest at the plate more than most catchers? Absolutely. It's kind of a little bit weird. It's definitely a hit over power profile, but there's some real hitting ability there, I think, to go with some real defensive ability. He doesn't throw all that great, but it's kind of the flip side of Dominic Keegan. Like his accuracy and how quick he gets the ball out, the fact that he puts it right on the bag kind of makes up for a little bit of a lack of arm strength. That's a great combo to have. Like, okay, we got this one catcher who maybe it all falls apart because he's very young and there's a lot of things that have to still develop, but he could be a stud. And then you have this other catcher who also will probably be starting the year somewhere in A-ball, but moving up relatively quickly because he was a college guy, who you look at and you say, he may not have the upside, but he also doesn't have a whole lot of things that he has to improve dramatically to be big league caliber because the defense is pretty polished. I don't want to ever say for a guy coming from amateur baseball to pro baseball, the defense is big league ready. I said that about Connor Burns with the Reds, who you'd also say his bat is not college ready. So like there's a little bit of trade-off there, but most of the time you would say, okay, we'll see how he handles stuff. Bodine handles some stuff. But then you would say like the bat to ball skills, the awareness of the strike zone, all that for Bodine is enough where he should have a little bit easier transition to pro ball than most college catchers. So that's a nice little kind of yin and yang that they have there.
Yeah. And it does seem like, you know, they could potentially have a couple of guys in the system right now that could develop into everyday catchers for the Rays, which would be a first in a long time.
That would literally be a first in organization history.
So that's very interesting. All right. Let's sort of wrap up the show here, JJ, with more of a general question. You might have already talked about this name, but we can dig in a little bit deeper. Who's your sleeper in this system, particularly in the, you know, 11 to 30 range, maybe even deeper?
We mentioned Totten Gray before. He's not even in the 30 now, but I do think that you are talking about a guy who has, when we talk about real power potential, like he put on a show at Super 60, you know, one of the kind of early events that kind of starts the high school season last year. He's extremely strong. First baseman, outfielder, probably, and probably first base at the end of the day, but real offensive upside, kind of an intriguing guy to watch that way. I would also say, like, I'll say this is the keep an eye on for this year's sleeper. The Rays put Alex Cook on their 40 man. He's an interesting guy because he was a starter, small college starter, drafted, moved to the pen, had good stuff. Then they were like, hey, why don't we move him to the rotation? They moved him to the rotation, struggled to stay healthy as a starter. So they're like, okay, maybe we're overthinking this. Let's move him back to the pen. And looks really good. I think he's a pure reliever. Again, Ty Johnson could be flitting this, you know, also really good. But like Cook is a guy who I think you will see pitch in the big leagues for the Rays this year, probably in a, you know, I'll probably see him in Durham a good bit. Then I'll go, oh, Alex Cook isn't here this week. Next week, oh, Alex Cook is here this week. 3 weeks later, oh, Alex Cook is not here this week. That kind of role right now, because the Rays like to kind of keep everyone fresh. But I do think that that he's a guy to kind of remember. But I got to be honest, we could go on for another, with all the trades they made, we could go on for another 30 minutes. We could talk about Jackson Baumeister, who's really not, I mean, one would not say as a sleeper, but I would say if you just look at his numbers, his raw, you know, his just straight statistical numbers from the last year, he was much better than that, especially post-injury. You know, we could talk about, you know, Emelian Petre, who's kind of an interesting guy, the guy that middle infielder, Canadian infielder out of Kentucky. You know, there's just a lot of different kind of interesting guys here. It is now, after all these moves, a very deep system once again, and a fun one to write about.
And it's probably only going to get more fun in the coming year. So exciting times for the Tampa Bay Rays. And we'll see if they're still in Tampa Bay in 5 years, but could be the Orlando Rays or the Florida Rays. I don't know. We'll see. JJ, thank you for joining me today, diving into, I think, a really, really fun system with a lot of interesting players and a lot of moving parts, even since we did the handbook. So kudos to you to putting together a really good write-up on all these players. For all those tuning in, thank you for tuning in. Thank you for subscribing to Baseball America. If you are a subscriber, as JJ always says, it's why we get an opportunity to do what we do and love to do every single day here at Baseball America. That's it. We'll see you next time.